The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter and also from the Harvard Health Letter. I'm going to start with an article from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. This is the November 2022 issue. This article is entitled Herniated Discs, Managing the Pain. Every time you stroll, jump, jog, or pick up that towering basket of laundry, there are 23 small cushions keeping your spine safe as you move. These cushions, called discs, one between each of your 24 vertebrae, absorb the shock of your movements. These discs have a soft center called a nucleus, encased in a harder, rubbery outer layer called the annulus, not unlike a jelly donut. But with injury or age, discs can rupture, herniate, like jelly leaking out of the donut. If that rubbery ring breaks or fails for any reason, that allows the gooey center to come out. As it comes out, it can start to push on nerves, says Brett Friedman, MD, an orthopedic spine surgeon and chair of the Division of Orthopedic Spine Surgery at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. It can cause pressure as well as inflammation on the nerves, producing symptoms in the back, leg, or arm. Some herniated discs don't cause any symptoms, but others hurt a lot. Symptoms usually resolve in a matter of weeks or months, but you may need some help with pain management in the meantime. Over time, discs tend to lose some of their natural moisture and flexibility, making them prone to damage or warping. The outer layer of the disc may bulge out, or it may crack or tear, allowing the soft inner material to escape. This is variously known as a bulging, herniated, ruptured, or slipped disc. But all these terms mean that part of the disc is poking into a place that it does not belong. It's possible to have a herniated disc without having any symptoms. This happens to a lot of people. Says Mohammed Biden, MD, a neurosurgeon at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. They may first learn about a herniated disc while undergoing tests for a different issue. Any disc in your spine can rupture. However, herniated discs in the lower back are the most common and can lead to symptoms of sciatica. Sciatica is characterized by pain that radiates or shoots down the path of the sciatic nerve, which runs from the lower back through the hips and buttocks to the leg. A herniated disc in the neck, often referred to as a pinched nerve, can result in similar symptoms, although through the neck, shoulder, arm, and hand. The symptoms may include burning sensations or pain, a feeling like a jolt or electric shock, pain that worsens with coughing or sneezing, numbness, tingling, or weakness in the affected leg or arm. In severe cases, trouble controlling the bowels or bladder, which calls for urgent medical care. While aging discs are often to blame for a rupture, a disc may also rupture after an injury, such as twisting your back while lifting something heavy. Long-term stress on the disc, such as experiencing the constant vibrations that come with driving a truck, also can be a contributing factor. Other risks include smoking, being overweight, and excessive sitting. We have more pressure on our discs when we sit down than when we stand up, Dr. Friedman says. Our spines weren't designed for us to be sitting for hours at a time. An imaging scan, like an MRI scan, can identify a herniated disc, but many people with herniated discs have no symptoms at all. Most herniated disc symptoms improve over time as the body breaks down and absorbs the excess disc material, relieving the pressure on the nerves. In the majority of cases, symptoms, particularly back and neck pain, will resolve on their own with time and anti-inflammatory medications, says Dr. Biden. For these reasons, your healthcare provider may not initially order any imaging tests. Instead, your provider may make a diagnosis of disc herniation based on your symptoms and by performing a physical exam to evaluate your muscle strength, as well as your sense of touch and your reflexes. Your provider will likely move your limbs in certain ways to determine which positions cause pain. This information may tell your provider which disc is affected. Typically, when you tell your spine surgeon where your symptoms are, they can backtrack and guess what nerve you're talking about. Because your arms and legs are wired in a very specific pattern, Dr. Friedman says. After a diagnosis, you'll need to modify your activities to avoid worsening your pain. Non-prescription pain relievers like ibuprofen and naproxen may help. Some providers may prescribe medications like muscle relaxants, drugs that affect nerve impulses like antidepressants and anti-seizure medications, or steroid injections. Injecting steroids near the spine nerves is a way to deliver steroids right on target to calm inflammation. If pain doesn't improve after several weeks, physical therapy may be recommended. Surgery for a herniated disc is a last resort treatment, but when it's needed, it can be a game changer. You can think of a disc herniation like having a rock in your shoe. If you have a small rock, you can walk and not even notice it. But when you have a large rock, every step hurts. Surgery is like removing the rock, he says. For some, the relief is immediate. A discectomy is typically performed. This surgery is to remove the protruding section of the disc to relieve pressure and inflammation. It usually also involves full or partial removal of the back portion of a vertebrae to access the ruptured disc. A discectomy can be performed through open surgery or through minimally invasive smaller incisions. Spine surgeons often use a microscope to help them see the herniated disc. As we refined our techniques and our technology, we've been able to limit the collateral damage of discectomy by reducing the size of the incision and the size of the tissue removal. But spine surgery is a pretty invasive thing, no matter how small our incision and how little dissection we do. Your spine is almost in the middle of you at your low back, so the distance from your skin down to your spine can be several inches. In rare cases, such as with repeat herniation of the disc, the entire disc is removed. To keep the spine stable, a surgeon can then fuse the vertebrae with screws, rods, and bone graft called a spinal fusion, or insert an artificial disc. Discectomy can be performed as same-day surgery, Dr. Friedman says. Radiating leg and arm pain usually improve, while improvement in back and neck pain is less likely. This is because there are many causes for back or neck pain that have nothing to do with disc herniation. There's only one reason for shooting leg and arm pain. That one reason is a pinched nerve and inflammation. As long as the nerve becomes unpinched soon enough, the radiating pain usually resolves. Talk to your healthcare team to determine how long you'll need to rest and recover after surgery. Recovery from surgery can range from a few short weeks to many months, depending on the exact surgery, Dr. Biden says. Your doctor will provide more details on the type of recovery to expect. The Mayo Clinic Health Letter goes on with a shorter article called Health Tips. Are you drinking too much? Even without reaching a level of alcohol consumption defined as alcoholism, a person's drinking could still be risky or unhealthy. The National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism cautions against risky drinking. Risky drinking is defined in men age 65 and older, and women of any age, as an average of more than 7 drinks a week. In men under 65, it's more than 14 drinks a week. A drink is a 12-ounce beer, a 5-ounce glass of wine, or a mixed drink with 1.5 ounces of liquor, which is 40% alcohol. There's more to your relation with alcohol than just numbers. Ask yourself, is my tolerance creeping up? As your tolerance increases, you don't feel the effects of alcohol until you drink more. Some people have a naturally higher baseline alcohol tolerance, and tolerance develops over time with regular drinking. Either way, alcohol can cause adverse health consequences, even if you don't feel it. Am I breaking my own rules about drinking? If you say you'll never drive after a drink, or won't drink on weeknights, but find yourself doing so, it's time to reevaluate. This is especially important if your drinking puts others at risk, like by driving or caring for children while under the influence. Am I binging? 4 or more drinks for women and 5 or more for men in the span of 2 hours is considered binging. Binge drinking raises the risk of social, medical, and long-term alcohol problems. Am I drinking every day? When drinking is a nearly daily activity, it can be easy to gradually increase your consumption without much thought. It's important to reflect on the reasons why you're drinking every day. Am I drinking to deal with stress? Mayo Clinic experts say that a healthy relationship with alcohol is one that recognizes that drinking can be pleasant and tasty, but doesn't act as a substitute for healthier relaxation or coping strategies. To better manage stress, it's hard to beat exercise or spending time with family and friends. Now we're going to go on to an important article called Preventing Breast Cancer. Options for those at high risk. Again, this is the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of November 2022. You've never had breast cancer, but you know you're at high risk, maybe because your sister had breast cancer at a young age, or because you've had a breast biopsy that shows a concerning lesion, and you're worried. While it's important to schedule regular mammogram screenings, you may be able to do more than watch and wait. There are several risk-reducing medications, also known as preventative therapies, that can lower your risk of breast cancer. These drugs come with their own risks, so discuss the benefits and drawbacks with a healthcare provider. Who is at high risk? To know whether these medications are an option for you, a healthcare provider will determine your breast cancer risk. There are risk calculators for those who have never had breast cancer, like the National Cancer Institute's Breast Cancer Risk Assessment Tool, which is abbreviated BCRAT. Some calculators are available online, like the BC Risk Tool, which is available at bcrisktool.cancer.gov. That's bcrisktool.cancer.gov. But a health care provider can also help calculate and interpret the risk. More simply, you may be eligible for risk-reducing medications if you have one or more close relatives like your mother, sister, or daughter who have had breast cancer. Or if you've had a previous biopsy that shows non-cancerous but atypical breast cells, like atypical hyperplasia or lobular carcinoma in situ. Or if you've had a chest radiation treatment between the ages of 10 and 30. These medications also are used in women who have had hormone receptor positive breast cancer to help prevent the cancer from coming back, which is called a recurrence, or to prevent a new cancer from forming in the breast. Several drugs can lower your risk of breast cancer by reducing the amount or effect of estrogen, a hormone that influences the growth and development of many breast cancers. Some of these drugs also are used to treat breast cancer. Some of these preventative medications include SERMs, that's S-E-R-M-S, which means selective estrogen receptor modulators. And examples of these are tamoxifen and raloxifene, which is also called Evista. These are Food and Drug Administration approved for breast cancer prevention. These medications work by blocking the hormone receptors in the breast, which reduces estrogen's effects there. However, the drug exerts estrogen-like effects in other areas as well. Tamoxifen, unlike raloxifene, has this effect in the uterus, which increases uterine cancer risk in postmenopausal women. Raloxifene exerts estrogen-like effects on the bone, which can help prevent osteoporosis. Then there are aromatase inhibitors. These medications include anastrozole or Arimidex, letrozole or Femara, and exemestane or aromasin. They work by reducing the production of estrogen that continues in other tissues after the ovaries no longer produce it at menopause. They are only FDA approved to treat breast cancer and reduce cancer occurrence, but they may be prescribed off-label to prevent breast cancer. These medications are generally prescribed as daily pills taken for 5 years and are intended for those age 35 and older. Mayo Clinic experts say that the medications are about 40% to 60% effective at reducing the risk of invasive breast cancer. A healthcare provider can help you to manage the side effects like hot flashes and vaginal dryness. So just to summarize, two drug classes have been mentioned so far, the SERMs and the aromatase inhibitors. There are also non-medication methods. First of all, you should maintain a healthy weight, exercising regularly, and you should also limit alcohol. This plays a role in reducing breast cancer risk. Also, you should get regular breast imaging screening. If you're at a higher risk of breast cancer, talk with your healthcare provider to determine the most appropriate screening option going forward. This may include regular breast magnetic resonance imaging, in addition to annual mammograms. Genetic testing. Depending on your family history, you or a family member may be referred to a genetic counselor to consider testing for risk-increasing genetic changes, like the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. Then there's surgical prevention. Some people opt for surgery to remove the breasts, called prophylactic mastectomy, or to remove the ovaries, called prophylactic oophorectomy, to decrease their risk. In certain cases, breast removal can reduce the risk of breast cancer by 90%. There are benefits of ovary removal to prevent breast cancer if this is performed during the premenopausal years. Now we're going to go over a brief section of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter that's called News and our views. And the first thing is entitled, Seizure Disorders Call for Drowning Caution. It's good to be vigilant when young children are by a pool, lake, pond, or even the bathtub. Young children who can't swim are in danger of drowning, even in very small bodies of water. But drowning isn't just a children's issue. A recent study in the CMAJ, which is the Canadian Medical Association Journal, showed that some adults should take extra precautions against drowning as well. The study examined drowning deaths that occurred over a decade to see whether medical conditions increase the risk of drowning. The data showed that seizure disorders like epilepsy increased drowning risk, especially in a bathtub. Young women with a seizure disorder were 20 times more likely to die by drowning than young women without a seizure disorder. Because experiencing a seizure in the bathtub can lead to drowning, it's best to take showers rather than baths. A shower base with a short lip or no lip prevents water from building up if someone has a seizure. Mayo Clinic experts recommend against showering in a tub with a pop-up drain stopper. Use an occupied sign rather than locking the door so that someone could assist you if needed. Consider an elevated shower seat or bench to prevent falling during a seizure. A lifeguard can't be expected to recognize a seizure in a busy pool. Those with a seizure disorder should be accompanied by a responsible, rescue-capable adult in or next to the pool. Also, designate a buddy when swimming and use a life jacket in open water. It's also important to take any seizure medication just like you are directed. Regardless of any medical condition, always take basic precautions against drowning. Don't swim or take part in other water activities like boating if you've been drinking. And consider an adult swim class if you're not confident in your swimming skills. The next article in News and Our Views in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter is entitled, Zinc May Help to Tackle Respiratory Infections. The effect of zinc on colds has been a matter of research debate for decades. A recent analysis published in BMJ Open, that's a British medical journal, suggests that zinc might have some benefits, including shortened illness and milder symptoms. The researchers analyzed 24 studies for evidence of zinc's ability to prevent or treat respiratory infections. Overall, taking zinc was associated with a 32% lower risk of developing mild to moderate symptoms of a respiratory tract infection when it was compared with taking a placebo. Zinc also was linked to an 87% lower risk of developing moderately severe flu-like symptoms, like a fever. However, the results for symptom severity were based on only a handful of studies. In addition, participants who took zinc under the tongue or as a nasal spray recovered from their upper respiratory symptoms an average of 2 days earlier than those who used the placebo. But those taking zinc also were more likely to experience side effects like nausea and mouth and nose irritation. There were no serious side effects like loss of smell. Most colds are caused by a type of virus called the rhinovirus, which thrives and multiplies in the nasal passage. Zinc may work by preventing viruses from multiplying and stopping them from lodging in the nose and throat. However, as with earlier zinc studies, caution is needed. Many of the studies analyzed were based on low-quality evidence. The research also didn't fill in important blanks, like the optimal dosing and the time of starting treatment. Until more conclusive research is available, Mayo Clinic experts recommend talking to your healthcare provider before considering zinc to prevent or reduce the length of colds. Now I'm going to briefly cover another section of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter called Second Opinion. Question. I'm nervous about visiting family this holiday season because I'll be the only one still wearing a mask. Does a mask offer me any protection if I'm the only person wearing one? Answer. In an ideal pandemic response scenario, everyone would be wearing a mask. Masks offer two-part protection. They limit the number of viral droplets released into the air by an infected person, and they reduce the number of droplets that a person may inhale. Combining mask wearing with vaccination, hand washing, air filtration, and social distancing is your best defense. But even if you're the only one wearing a mask, it can still offer you significant protection. How much protection depends on the type of mask and whether it's worn properly. A recent modeling study found that someone talking with an unmasked person who has COVID-19 while wearing a surgical mask and seated 5 feet away has a 90% chance of getting infected after a half an hour of exposure. Surgical masks are loose-fitting, disposable masks meant to block large particles. Those wearing devices to filter airborne particles, in other words, respirators, including high-quality masks like N95 or KN95 masks, had a 20% risk of infection after talking with the person for an hour. So the N95 mask is much more effective under these circumstances. People who reported always wearing respirators or N95 masks indoors in public spaces were 83% less likely to test positive for COVID-19 than people who said they didn't mask up inside. People wearing surgical masks or cloth masks were 66% and 56% less likely to test positive, respectively. Well, I think we're going to have to stop at this point. We've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.